Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org.
Welcome. Thank you for coming. We're here today to honor someone we love, D. Michael Quinn, and thank him for his contributions in our lives and to Mormon history and the great example that he set for us. I'd also like to mention some people who've helped us get this together. First of all, thank you to Sunstone for paying for Michael's travel here, and Mary Ellen is in the audience today if you'd like to catch her. And thanks go out right there in the back. Thanks go out to... to Benchmark Books for helping us bring many of you here, hopefully. They have some books back here to sell, and 10% of the proceeds will go to Michael himself, so find a nice title. More than anything, though, we want to thank our donors. It's because of the donations that we receive that we are able to put on special events like this, all of our regional conferences, keep our podcasts going. We've got some sponsored projects that are coming up, and so... it's the donors who've taken that time to go to MormonStories.org and click those buttons and just make a small donation that really keep us alive. So thank you very much. Speaking of conferences, we have three conferences coming up. In Atlanta, between the 26th and 28th of August, there will be the Southeast Regional Conference, and they are meeting at a resort, Callaway Gardens. Sounds like it's going to be fun, kayaking, all sorts of exciting things. Then we have the D.C. Regional Conference will be between October 14th and 16th, I believe, and it will be held at Greg Prince's home, and he will be our keynote speaker. And then we have a new kind of conference coming up. We're having an LGBTQ conference, and that will be here in Salt Lake City, November 4th through 6th, excuse me, and that will be held just right down the street at the First Baptist Church. And Carolyn Pearson will be coming. We've got a great agenda lined up, so you won't want to miss that. We expect to have a very good time. At the Salt Lake Conference this past June, we read a first draft of our Mormon Stories Shared Value Statement. And we wrote it in hopes of clearly articulating all of the values that we agree upon or try to agree upon, considering how much we tend to disagree about, especially online as we're debating and discussing these issues that are important to us. And we received a lot of feedback for the Shared Value Statement, and we were able to update it. So now I have a second official draft to read to you today. But again, I'd like to accentuate that this is just a draft. It is open for discussion, and we will be hopefully hearing more and revising again. Number one. We claim the right to self-identify as Mormons if we so choose. We may claim this identity based upon our genealogies, upbringings, beliefs, relationships, and other life experiences. Number two, we believe that one can be Mormon or claim a Mormon identity without necessarily adhering to the teachings or doctrines of any religious organization. Number three, we acknowledge the richness of Mormon heritage, teachings, and community in all of its diversity. Number four, we seek spaces where we as Mormons can live lives of intellectual and spiritual integrity, individual conscience, and personal dignity. Number five, we acknowledge and honor different spiritual paths and modes of religious or non-religious truth-seeking. We respect the convictions of those who subscribe to ideas and beliefs that differ from our own. Number six, we recognize the confusion, distress, emotional trauma, and social ostracism that people on faith journeys often experience. We seek constructive ways of helping and supporting people, regardless of their ultimate decisions regarding church affiliation or activity. And number seven, we affirm the inherent and equal worth of all human beings. We seek spaces where Mormons and all people can interact as equals, regardless of race, gender, or sexual orientation. In this spirit of egalitarianism, we prefer non-authoritarian and non-hierarchical means of organization and affiliation. We're going to begin today with a musical number by Kevin Jacobson. Kevin is a non-LDS gay Christian songwriter who composed this piece for his LDS friends after a particularly discouraging conference talk was given not too long ago. The song is entitled, Hold On.
In the And you wonder if anyone else could feel this way. Unworthy of God's love, at least what you've been told. But he is waiting for you and reaching out his hand.
Dear God, our eternal heavenly parents, we're grateful to gather here in this beautiful place of worship with the large windows and the natural light that enters in. And we pray for thy spirit to be with us this evening as we get the opportunity to listen to someone of Michael Quinn, who has done a great service to all of us and especially the Mormon community in unraveling and articulating our stories. And we look forward to hearing his story as a Mormon historian this evening. We're grateful for those who have made this evening possible, Anne and John and Mary Ellen and many others who helped organize this. And we pray that as we each go on our own journeys of of faith and spirituality, that we will maintain and strengthen all the relationships in our life, our friendships, and our relations with our families. And we pray for thy guidance in all that we do. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you, Kevin and Rebecca. Michael Quinn is a man who has made his own indelible mark on Mormon history. In my mind, his painstakingly thorough research and well-written presentations affect current open Mormon thought more than many of us probably realize. In his possibly most influential works, Early Mormonism and the Magic World View, The Mormon Hierarchy, Origins of Power, and The Mormon Hierarchy, Extensions of Power, Quinn candidly presents us with a well-written synthesis of the fascinating primary source material. Much of the history he unveils centers around issues that we 21st century open Mormons grapple with on the internet on a daily basis. Quinn is both demanding and respectful of his readers. The history he so candidly presents requires that we attempt to put aside our own biases and delve into history for its own sake. He challenges us to let go of unreasonable ideals of infallibility. He asks us to explore with him both the inspirational and the embarrassing and regrettable parts of our history. And more, his writings somehow, perhaps unwittingly, I don't know, seem to challenge us to allow ourselves to confront the uncomfortable and to incorporate any new insights we might then gain into our personal senses of morality. I think Quinn expects a lot of us because he respects us. Instead of babying us by working to make history palatable to our modern worldviews, he allows it to speak for itself. It's a beautiful thing, I think, to when you're reading a book, to know that that you're important to the author and you're going to get it straight. Quinn was hired by Leonard Arrington during the so-called Camelot years between 1972 and 1982. And with a fairly ferocious tenacity, he kept right on trucking in his quest to present Mormon history with frankness after the decade was over. In addition to the three works I mentioned above, he authored and later revised a notable biography on J. Reuben Clark, a thought-provoking book on same-sex dynamics among 19th century Americans, using Mormons as an example, and a book of collected essays on the topic of New Mormon history. He has also published several articles on Mormon history, and one of the most influential being a detailed analysis of post-manifesto polygamy. He retired from his teaching position at BYU in 1988 and was excommunicated as one of the either famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, September 6 in 1993. More recently, he's been barred from teaching positions and speaking engagements, presumably, according to Daniel Golden of the Wall Street Journal, because funders will not support him. It's no wonder, then, considering all, that in 2003 at a Sunstone conference, Quinn quoted from Tennyson's Ulysses a passage that accurately reflects his resolute approach to research history and speaking his personal truth. The quote: "To strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." Thanks for being here, Michael, and thanks for having guts. So, come on up, Michael and John.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for being willing to come on Mormon Stories.
Glad to.
You've been the number one guest that I've hoped to get on the show for many, many years, and I'm just honored to be able to have you here. And I'm also very grateful for all of you who'd be willing to come. We've never done a live Mormon Stories podcast interview, so Michael, if you want, you can just ignore the fact that all these people are here.
It's okay.
And pretend that
I'll pretend you're
just
my students. Which is nice. I always loved having a room full of students.
That's great. I've asked many of you to submit questions, so I've tried to pull together many of the questions from your submissions. We will try and leave a little time at the end for a few of you to ask some questions of Michael. And then what I think is going to be the most important part of this whole event is giving each of you guys a chance, not each of you, a few of you a chance to share with Michael maybe what his work has meant to a few of you, to maybe give back to him and thank him for what he's given us. And I also want to thank all of you for your generous donations which we will make sure Michael shares and benefits from. So, so excellent. Well, let's get going with the interview.
Okay.
So, so Michael, the way we always begin Mormon Stories is just to ask people a little bit about their background, kind of their upbringing, as it relates to kind of their story and their life's work. I know that the number one question that I receive on your behalf and that I have, you know, is the following, you know, is Michael Quinn still a believer in, you know, the restoration? And, you know, how can he maintain that belief? And I don't know if that's changed since the last time you've done some interviews, but I get a pretty clear sense that the testimony that you've had, at least traditionally and maybe still have, is rooted in your childhood.
Yeah.
So let's start with kind of a little bit about your childhood in the church and some of the experiences you've had that led to your desire to study history and your convictions.
Well, I had a mixed background. My mother was a sixth-generation Mormon, and not from a prominent family, but a family that converted in Tennessee and then moved to Nauvoo in 1843. And my father was Roman Catholic, and he was a Mexican but denied being Mexican, and that is a very fundamental part of my issue with probing the past, because I began doing genealogy research against his explicit desires because I wanted to find out about my ancestry, even if he didn't want me to find out about it. And that determination carried over into my research on Mormon history, and so there's a parallel there. Incidentally, my father's name was not Quinn when he was born. It was Peña, which means stone in Spanish.
Peña?
Peña,
okay.
With a tilde over the N. And he grew up in the Los Angeles barrio with Anthony Quinn, the actor, and was so close to him that he changed his name to Quinn, never legally, but just adopted the name Quinn. So I was the first one born with the name Quinn in my family. I grew up with my primary awareness of family as being divorced. My parents divorced when I was four, and religion was a part of that issue. And I was raised in a Mormon home because my mother was very Mormon, and my grandparents, her parents, were the ones who jointly raised me until I was 11, and she remarried and was going to move to Arizona, and I said, I'm not moving with you, and I'm going to stay with my grandparents. And so I stopped living with my mother at that time, which is an indication, perhaps regretfully, but I have an iron will, and I was 11 when I made that decision, and it, for better or worse, is a characteristic throughout my life, that if I decide I want to do something, I will do it. If I decide I don't want to do something, I don't. I had, from my earliest memories, a very intense relationship with God, and I prayed to God as though he were my father, and as I look at it back from the perspective of psychology or just of the distance of age, I can see that in many ways God the Father became my substitute father. And the intensity of that relationship was something that I didn't have in my life, but that I did have with God. And it was very easy for me to talk with God in prayer, and when I prayed publicly, I carried that over into my public prayers, which for me were just another manifestation of my private relationship with God. And for me, it was a physical relationship, in the sense that before I had ever read the Doctrine and Covenants about the burning in the bosom, or heard that, that was something I experienced. It was for me a tactile, real experience of God's presence, which I later understood was the Holy Ghost, but for me it was God's presence. And I knew that and have known that since I was a child. And that's been my primary revelatory experience with God, is feeling that primarily it's been a message of comfort, that I've known God was there, that he was real, that he loved me, and that I was, you know, important to him. Sometimes it has been what I've understood as revelatory, but most of the time it's been just a comfort of knowing that God was there for me. And that hasn't changed. My excommunication didn't change that. Baptism can't give you a relationship with God, and excommunication can't take it away. That's something that's separate, that each individual must work out with God. And for me, it's still a very real thing. In terms of my formal testimony of the restoration of Joseph Smith of the Book of Mormon, I'm pretty conservative. I believe in gold plates. I believe in an angel Moroni. I believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, but not exclusive. Brigham Young himself said that people throughout the world and many cultures have prophets, and they're true prophets, and they have revelations, and they're true revelations, but Brigham said Joseph is our prophet for us, and his revelations are for us. And that's how I feel. I don't believe Mormonism has any monopoly on truth. I don't believe that Mormonism has exclusive truth. When I was a teenager, I was studying Baha'i and Islam and Buddhism, as well as many Christian denominations. And my view was, what I'd understood was the view of the church, was that we were supposed to embrace truth from whatever source. And that was my attitude then, and it continues to be my attitude, even though in many ways I would regard myself as a fundamental believer, a conservative believer in the essentials of Mormonism.
But doesn't D&C 1 kind of make the claim that it's kind of the one and only true church, and that all others are inferior, to put it nicely, or lesser? And doesn't just the implications of priesthood and authority kind of leave you to have to conclude as a traditional believer that we are superior and that others are lesser?
I don't know when I developed this particular attitude toward the church, but it may have been a talk that Hubie Brown gave in our ward. His son was a member of our ward, a professor at USC, and I was the same age as his grandson, Charlie. And in the talk that Hubie Brown gave, he said that when we go to other people as missionaries, we sometimes try to tear down their religion in order to give them Mormonism. But he said, what we should do is tell them, and the missionaries should say, keep all the truth you have. We just have more truth. And if you'll listen to us, I think you will agree with us. And that's been my approach, that Mormonism is the true church in the sense that it has truths that other religions, other churches don't have, but it doesn't have exclusive truth. And I can learn from Buddhism, I can learn from Baha'i, I can even learn from Jehovah's Witnesses, even though I don't subscribe to many of their very literal interpretations of the Bible. Nonetheless, I believe that the message of Joseph Smith in the 13th Article of Faith and the message of the Mormonism I understand is that it is not exclusive. It is the true church in the sense that it has an abundance of truth to share, but not that it has all truth.
The most truth?
I don't know that most applies because we know very little about the afterlife. Mormons talk very often among themselves as though they know everything, and we know very little, but we know essential things about the afterlife, and it could be that a good Buddhist knows more than we do. Or that I do. But I think that all of us, as humans, do what Paul wrote, and that is we see through a glass darkly. We don't perceive more than shadows in a Platonic sense of the truth. And the ultimate goal is for us to continue growing from truth to truth, from understanding to understanding, until ultimately we gain all truth. If that can be done, but I also believe in a progressive God, which was what Jean England, my great mentor in Mormon liberalism, believed in. So we may never come to the point where we understand all truth, where we instead are always progressing from knowledge to knowledge and truth to truth.
It sounds a lot like Gordon B. Hinckley's testimony to Larry King, which is kind of mind-blowing to hear a testimony from you that reminds me of one of our prophets, which... I'm just saying that, you know, there's some would find that ironic. I think it's beautiful. But we'll return to your testimony later. Let's talk about a few of the experiences that you've referred to that kind of solidified for you, that maybe you took as signs, something about your health, something about a trip into some caves that kind of, well, I don't know if you call them as signs or things that really affirmed, that solidified your testimony?
Well, shortly after my parents divorced, I was one of the many children in the United States who got polio in a major epidemic that swept periodically throughout the United States. And I ended up collapsing at home, and I remember this. And as my parents were, or my grandparents rather, were rushing me to the doctor first, who said, go to the county hospital immediately. As they were doing that, I insisted that they stop and go to an old member of the ward who was in his 60s. I'm older now than he was then, but he was old to me. And as a four-year-old, I wanted him to give me a blessing. And I don't know really where that came from. My grandparents were surprised that I asked for it, but I insisted that he give me a priesthood blessing. And in the blessing he gave me, he said that he rebuked the illness and said that I would leave the hospital in a few weeks and that I would have no residual effects from the disease. I don't know if he knew at that point that it was polio, but it was polio, and it was the fatal kind, bulbar polio, which is inflammation of the brain stem. I was in the hospital for about a month, 3 weeks or so, and the boy in the bed next to me, we were in this large room of children in these metal beds that were the standard back then. He died, and I remember the nurses coming in and bundling him up and taking his body away. And yet I had terrible memories and continue to remember those spinal taps that I had and the hot packs and the Sister Kinney approach of hot packs and muscle massage. But I left the hospital after a few weeks, and I had no residual effects of that. And I have never been able to understand why that blessing was fulfilled in my life, and yet I had friends who had polio and also had blessings of priesthood and of faith, and they had a more difficult time. Most of them had damage to their muscles because of the polio. And I don't understand why that is the case. I regard, in many ways, the interventions of God as inscrutable. I'm grateful for the interventions. I'm grateful for the blessings that God has given me, and I have no understanding of why others have not been so blessed, but I can only be grateful, and I always pray when I do pray. I can't claim to pray every day, but I vocalize my prayers often, and when I do, I usually start with about 10 or 15 minutes of thank yous. I have a very real, continue to have a very real relationship with God. And I feel that spirit and presence with me now. I have felt it in non-spiritual, quote-unquote, experiences, whether I'm watching TV or watching a Hollywood movie, and I love both and have since I was a kid. For me, the spirit is not, quote, a religious experience. It's a experience of a relationship, and that can remain whether you're at the beach or in a movie theater or wherever. The other experience I had that was, for me, it was a dramatic one, occurred when I was 9, and my family, my grandparents, frequently took me to Idaho and in the summers, and we would typically go up the California coastline into Oregon and then cut across to Idaho to visit my grandmother's side of the family. And that was routine summer trip. Well, this time, this particular trip, we went to, and I've never been able to remember what they were called. I've always called them the Oregon Caves, but there were some subterranean caves that had the stalactites and the from the dripping of the water in the ceiling. And as is typical, I understand, in these kinds of guided tours, the tour guide turned off the lights for a demonstration of total darkness. And at that point, I had been separated from the group. I'd been just kind of looking at my own pace at things that interested me. And so I started to catch up as he was continuing to talk to the crowd. I went in the direction that I thought they were, his voice was coming from. And I'd taken a few steps, and I felt and heard, and I can only describe it as one experience, that I felt and heard a voice that said, stop. And I thought it was an echo from his voice, and so I hesitated and then continued walking, and then it came very dramatically, very emphatically, stop. And I stopped. And when the lights came back on, I had been going away from the crowd, and it was the echo and the effect of the echoes in the dark, and I was just a foot or two from a sheer drop that into a precipice of some sort in the caves. And as a child, I always bore my testimony, and I've remained with that testimony to this day, that God's voice protected me from death. Now again, as an older person, seeing people of my acquaintance dying, reading about them in the newspapers, missionaries dying in mission fields, I don't understand why that was my experience, but I have never doubted that that was God's voice.
Why not? And here's why. I'll ask that question. And this is a bit ironic, both because I've had it happen to me, and maybe you've had people say this has happened to you, but when you discuss church history in a candid way, people who listen and learn about what you might say or write find often their worldview shattered. And when their worldview is shattered, they think back to the pillars of their faith, which is often, spiritual experiences like the ones you described. And it's really common for people to just decide to kind of reinterpret them, to say, well, I thought I heard a voice, but that could have been instinct, or, Darwinism evolved me to have a sense to know what was coming on, or, those feelings that I got, or that polio miracle that happened to me was just kind of good medical care, or a robust set of genes that differentiated you, or whatever the explanation might be. And it's pretty easy for people to just sort of reinterpret and then sometimes dismiss what they used to think were spiritual experiences. And you, of all people, might have had cause to feel pressure to go that way. And there's probably a lot of people here or who are listening who are thinking, what the heck? You know, Michael Quinn, like, I read his stuff, and now I don't have, my worldview's been shattered, yet he's still saying he's a literal true believer and hasn't reinterpreted all the things that I've reinterpreted. And so, did you never even reach a point where you considered that?
Not because of history. I became an atheist for a brief time on my mission. But I grew out of it. But the reason for it had nothing to do with history. I was 20-year-old president of a branch that had collapsed into apostasy.
Where?
In England. A stake was formed later in that area. But
what year was this?
It was 64. I was 1964 in the summer.
So this is after Woodbury?
Yes, it was after it was the cleanup of the baseball baptism period.
Was Hanks there at the time in Holland?
I had served under President Hanks for 7 months, but he had left in the spring, shortly before I was appointed as the presiding elder of this branch. But as a part of the cleanup for all of the abuses of the baseball baptism period, our resident apostle, Mark E. Peterson, instituted a program of excommunication for those who chose not to remain in the church. And many of them had not even known they were entering a church.
Describe real quick what baseball baptisms were.
It was a youth program, an outreach program that had been established first in the British mission under the leadership of a man named Woodbury, President Woodbury. I don't think he thought of it himself. It was local missionaries, full-time missionaries, who thought of the idea of using baseball to draw children, boys primarily, but also girls, into an interest in the church. And in theory, that was fine. I mean, any approach, whether it's preaching eternal marriage or many different approaches, can interest people in the church. The problem was that many of these kids were interested only in the sport and not in learning about Mormonism. And so the missionaries said, well, to continue playing with us, you have to attend church. And so they grumbled and they went along with that. And then, because so much pressure was being put on missionaries to baptize, the missionaries said, well, now you're going to have to go through an initiation. And they took them to the YMCA and dunked them under the water and said they were being initiated into a baseball team.
And didn't they have like 1,000 baptisms a month?
You know, huge numbers. And so there were many children who were baptized. The missionaries sometimes forged their birth dates on their baptismal certificates. I interviewed boys who were baptized at the age of 6. And many interviewed that thought they were joining a baseball club or a sports club and had no idea they were, they thought it was sponsored by the church, but they had no idea that they were becoming members of the church. Well, anyway, because of these various abuses, President Peterson initiated the program of first doing a survey of all the inactives, thousands, tens of thousands of inactives who by 1964 may have been teenagers, that was the most they were. And all the boys I interviewed were teenagers and had been baptized anywhere from the age of 6 to 10. Some were baptized as teenagers, most weren't. And if they didn't want to remain members of the church, then we were to excommunicate them. Well,
that's because that was the only way to get them off the records.
Right.
There
was no option at that point in the general handbook for voluntary withdrawal. And so as a 20-year-old, I was in the process of first I have interviewed all these boys, and then I was in the process of holding formal excommunication courts for them. And as I think about what happened within me internally, I think it was easier for me to believe that none of it mattered than that everything mattered. And that to think that the church wasn't true, that there was no priesthood, there might not even be a God, than to think all of this had happened and that I was participating in this process of excommunicating these boys from God's true church. So anyway, for a period of time, while I was preparing these courts, I had become an atheist. And so I remembered all these experiences, and far more than I've mentioned, very clearly. But that memory of them did not alter the fact that I had to pray, "Oh God, if there is a God, and you are God, let me know it again." And that was a prayer I was offering every day as a missionary. And this period lasted only 2 weeks, and being an atheist, only 2 weeks is probably not a record, but it wasn't a very long period. But I had decided that if I wasn't going able to regain faith, that I was going to ask to be sent home from my mission and probably leave the church. So the stakes were high for me. I could not just play a game. As it turned out, faith returned and the Spirit of God returned, and I renewed my convictions and all of the things that I had believed. But for the first time in my life, I knew what it was like to feel abject disbelief, which I had felt for that 2 week period while I was conducting meetings and being the spiritual leader of this branch of six people, active people who were attending and depending on me as the branch president or presiding elder. And that was an awful situation, and one that I could not have allowed to endure very long. So I have come to the position of disbelief. I have, for that brief period, been an absolute doubter, but it had nothing to do with history. And I found when I read things, and before I went on the mission, I was burrowing into the special collections at BYU, reading about the Danites in Missouri and blood atonement and all of this stuff. And when I was, prior to going on my mission, I just prayed for the Lord's Spirit to be with me, to reassure me of what was true, and to help me sort out what was true and what was false, and what needed to be understood to a greater degree. And I just have a quirky sense of humor. Before I went to the temple, I read all the anti-Mormon exposés, so I would understand what was going on in the temple beyond what I had been told in official ways. And with that preparation, I regarded the temple ceremony in its entirety as moving, as spiritual, and because I'd read the anti-Mormon approach, and there was nothing there that was disturbing to me. It's not something I would recommend to anybody else, but it was part of my quirky testimony and way of negotiating my membership and faith in the church. So I can't say that I've ever had a trial of faith connected with church history. I have found things that disturbed me, things that I didn't understand, and I first brought them up when I was 17, Adam, God, plural marriage after the manifesto, to LeGrand Richards, who was also a frequent visitor in our ward because his daughter was married to our bishop. And we were trapped. He was trapped with me and my questions on New Year's Eve when it was on Sunday, and we couldn't go to our regular New Year's Eve dance. And so we had this meeting in his son-in-law's home, and he bore his testimony about being a missionary in Holland and mission president in Holland and then a mission president in the southern states. And then after he'd spoken for about half an hour, he asked for questions that we might have. And he didn't know what he was in for, because I ask about Adam God and I ask about plural marriage after the manifesto, both of which I learned about that summer before. So I felt that the issues that I was coming across in church history needed to be explored. And his answers to my questions I found very reasonable. About Adam God, he said, as an apostle, There were many things that he did not understand about that Brigham Young had preached, and he just put them on the shelf. And he said, one day when I am able to meet Brigham, I'm going to ask him about these things and what he meant, what I should understand about them. And I thought that was a very faithful, very honest way to approach the question of Adam God. And about when I asked him about plural marriage after the manifesto, he said, well, that he had asked his father about it, who had replaced John W. Taylor in the 12 when John W. Taylor was released. And his father, George F. Richards, said that John W. Taylor was a very proud man. And I'd read the family biography, and that pride came through. I mean, it was clear to me that his father was a proud man and didn't like being treated the way he was being treated. And so that simple answer that pride was the basic reason for people who continued practicing polygamy, that satisfied me until a few years later when I found out that that wasn't the explanation. But it was a sincere one on the part of LeGrand Richards, and although I set that one aside as not being sufficient, his response to Adam God, I think, is a great response, that there are things we don't understand, and rather than let them eat at us, why not put them on the shelf? In a Greek sense, the term is withhold judgment. Why not withhold judgment about something that we don't understand or know enough about? And so I do that with a lot of
people. Can I lovingly say you've helped us all fill our shelves full?
Yeah, well, I didn't intend to do that, but I knew in writing the books that I wrote that for some people, this would be their reason for leaving the church. And I felt that I had a dual responsibility. I had a responsibility to present the evidence about this issue or various issues as best I could, as best I understood it, to acknowledge that there was a position not of faith that one could understand this from, but also to affirm that there was a position of faith that one could understand this from. But you had to re-examine your faith and reinterpret it. And I acknowledge that that would be the case. That, as I explained it to others about the magic worldview, it was like to other people that. It was like looking at the optical illusion, and some people can see only two faces, and the other people see the outline of a vase. And when your mind switches and you can see what you were not able to see before, you can never go back to seeing only one side of the optical illusion. You know the other side is there, and sometimes your mind flips, even as you're looking at it, back and forth. And that's how I perceived early Mormonism. I could never go back to understanding early Mormonism without the influence of magic and the occult. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, for me it was a necessary thing, and I felt that that would also be the best resolution that readers of the book could come to. And I recognized that others would choose a simpler path with another approach of philosophy, and that is accept the Occam's razor approach. The simplest answer is the best answer, and for many the simplest answer is Joseph Smith was a fraud and a charlatan, and this proves it. And I actually, while I was at BYU, a few months after I published it, I had a student who told me his stake president had passed on to him what he wanted me to tell him was the result when his son read that book. And his son, a returned missionary, came in, slammed my book down on his father's desk and said, "This is the last straw. I'm leaving the church." And that's not why I wrote the book, but even as I wrote it, I knew that some could come to that conclusion.
I liked what Ann said at the beginning about you having confidence both in the church and in your readers. Do you feel like that's part of the conviction that kind of led you to the honesty?
I think that it's a condescending attitude that some leaders have that they can understand these problem areas and they can know about them because their faith is so strong, they would never fall. But we can't allow the unwashed masses to have this knowledge or they would leave the church. I regard that as spiritually arrogant and as a disconfirming lack of confidence in the faith of average members of the church. I see no reason why a new convert or a longtime member of the church cannot have a stronger testimony than an apostle. There is absolutely no reason why an apostle should have a stronger testimony than an average member. Everyone is entitled to the power of God in whatever form God wants to reveal himself or herself to the person. And I think it undermines the church to have this condescending attitude toward the weakness of the faith in average members. And so my point of view is that I don't want to topple people's faith because that can be done if they're not prepared, but the effort that I've encouraged is start preparing them in seminary with just, you know, a tidbit a week that there is a humanity. Once a week isn't much to ask, and you can do this with teenagers to say, yes, there were problems in Missouri, and some of them we brought on ourselves as a people. End of startling revelation. And that's the one for that week, and allow the students to assimilate that and ask follow-up questions, and maybe another week refer to something else, like Joseph Smith did have multiple wives. That at least opens the door to teenagers that there is a more complex experience of Mormonism than they themselves may know about. And that way they're not going to be blindsided by these, and primarily evangelical Protestants who use Mormon history as a battering ram to destroy the faith of members of the church who haven't heard of these things. And I think it's healthy to give what Leonard Arrington called an inoculation of a small dose of these realities, so that if they're blindsided, they're not going to be destroyed, which is the whole purpose of inoculation in a medical sense. And I think that approach can be used in teaching children, teaching teenagers, teaching adults, teaching converts. And but I can't do that in a book. I can't go to every individual reader and say, you know, this is what I hope for you. All I can do is say, I'm, as I have in my prefaces, say I'm a believer, and I believe that this information can provide a broader understanding of the Mormon experience that does not undermine faith, but it will change your understanding of the Mormon past, because anytime we understand something more deeply, whether it's music or literature or the religion, it changes our understanding of that thing the more we learn about it. And so that's what I've done. And then once I've laid that out, usually in the preface, then it's no holds barred from that point forward.
Gloves are off.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm thinking about your time during the Leonard Arrington years. I believe it was Davis Bitten who first brought you on. Before we get to that, I remember you tell a story about an interview you had with Spencer W. Kimball where he made a promise to you. Is that right?
It wasn't before that. It was before I went to Yale.
Okay.
It was.
Tell that story real quick, if you don't mind.
Well, I was finishing up my year and a half, or I've been about a year with Leonard at the point that I wanted to go to Spencer W. Kimball. And what I really wanted to talk about was this spiritual arrogance, I guess is the way to describe it, of thinking that I was going to be an apostle one day. And I, this had been encouraged by people in my ward, by my grandmother, and I... As a missionary, I'd had an experience that seemed to reinforce that. And I, by the time I was been married 7 years, or 6 years, rather, 6 years. It was 1973, and I was gay, and my wife and I were struggling with my being gay. The idea that I could even still think of being an apostle was just preposterous to me, but I couldn't shake the feeling that this is what God wanted for me. So I thought if nothing else would change my mind, for me to be told by the president of the Quorum of the Twelve that this was a delusion, and if he could give me a blessing to overcome that delusion, then I could be at peace and maybe finally give up that delusion. And so that's what I went to see President Kimball for. And instead he said that that promise would be fulfilled, which didn't make my life any easier.
You still holding on hope that that might happen?
No. 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 Not a snowball's chance.
So he was speaking as a man when he said that.
I don't know. Or I was unworthy of the blessing. All I know is that there are many blessings that people receive, whether they're healing blessings or not, that are not fulfilled in the form that they're uttered. And why that is, the easy answer, the Occam's razor answer, is there is no God. And this is self-delusion, to think that you're receiving, or that this priesthood holder is receiving God's message when he says words over you. That's one approach. The other approach is the Job approach, which is the complex approach, not the Occam's razor approach, that you shake your hand at God in prayer and say, why? And God says, you don't know enough to understand the answer. And that's the message of Job, and that's the message that I've internalized. I don't understand enough.
Are you shaking your fist a little bit sometimes?
Oh, I have. Yeah, I have. That's my relationship with God. It's a parental-child relationship, and very often I'm the whiny child.
When did you first feel you were different in terms of your sexuality? And talk a little bit about being homosexual in the 60s and 70s in the church.
My mother perceived this in me when I was about six, but she didn't tell me this until I came out to her when I was an adult in middle age. And when I asked her as a middle-aged out man why she thought I was homosexually inclined, which was her term, and the common term. She remembering back, you know, as many years as she was having to remember back, she said that she couldn't remember anything in particular. It was just that I was different from other boys. And those differences in her mind when I was six added up to, well, maybe he's homosexually inclined. But because I... at age 12, read everything I could about homosexuality in the public library.
What year would this have been?
What year? When I was 12, 1956. And everything was negative.
Was that term even around back then?
Oh, yeah. Homosexuality was a term in the English language since 1892.
Okay.
But everything was negative.
It was like a mental disorder, right?
Uh-huh. And even the novels that were written, which I devoured by gay authors, they all ended unhappily. Suicide, death. I mean, it was just how it was presented, even by authors writing novels. That was the convention they had to follow in order to get published, to even deal with the topic. And it had to have a serves-you-right ending. And anyway, that was all I read when I was 12. And I read all of Kinsey, and I read Freud, and I read Havelock Ellis, and they were the experts
at 12.
At the time. Yeah.
He's reading Kinsey at 12. I just want to make that note.
Well, I'd begun this. My grandmother bought me the Encyclopedia Britannica when I was 12, and they were working class people. This was a big sacrifice. And so I decided that I would make their investment worthwhile, and so I started reading it page by page. It took me 8 years, but by the time I was 18, I'd finished all 23 volumes plus the index, I won't count, of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So I was just I was a kid who watched 20 hours of TV a week, who saw two or three movies a week, and who loved reading. And so I, you know, it was all of a piece for me. So reading Kinsey's Sexual Behavior of the Human Male from cover to cover was no biggie for me when I was 12. And Freud and Havelock Ellis and all, and everything was negative. And I just decided this isn't what God wants for me, and this isn't what I want for myself. And so I decided, and I have this iron will, that I was going to live a straight life and make it work. And it's you and me, God, and he was the only one I confided in. And so I started dating girls when I was 13, and just lived a celibate life and expected that when I got married, I would experience normal, quote-unquote, sexuality, and my homosexual needs and desires, and I recognized them as both desires and needs, but I felt that they would just kind of wither on the vine once I was experiencing wild animal sex with my beloved wife, who I've been sealed to.
How'd that go?
Well, wild animal sex with your wife when you're a closeted male makes your homosexual desires more prominent. You can't suppress one side of your sexuality while you're actively, and when I say suppress, you can't express the feelings. If you allow your feelings on the other side of the equation, if you are somewhere in the middle on the Kinsey scale and you can respond both sexually to males and females.
Is that where you put yourself, in the middle of the Kinsey
Not
scale?
Right in the middle. I'm more of like a four.
Four?
Yeah.
What's the max?
Scale.
Five or six?
Seven. Or pardon me, six. I wish I were a seven. It would have made my life easier. But six is the exclusively homosexual on the Kinsey scale.
So some attraction to the opposite.
Yeah. And I responded to my wife, and I loved my wife. But our lovemaking...
Did you tell her you were gay when you
Not when we got married, no. I thought, why
did
should
you think
I...
about it?
Oh, yeah.
But you were confident that you'd be cured, maybe.
Well, that, and also I thought,
cured.
Why should
Sorry.
I confess and possibly disrupt our engagement with being tempted? Because I'd never done anything.
So you never had any
no.
sexual relations? Or
no, so...
Never been abused?
Anyway, when the only way I could suppress my homosexuality once I was experiencing sex with my wife was to suppress my response to her. And, of course, this created all kinds of problems.
And so you wouldn't be intimate with your wife, so you wouldn't augment your feelings towards men.
Right. Because after having a night of sexual experience with my wife, I'd wake up in the middle of the night dreaming of doing that with a man. And
Was it uncomfortable or unpleasant to be with your wife?
No.
Okay,
no,
so it was okay.
It was okay. But a woman and a man in a marriage needs more than a spouse who's okay with them. They need someone who's ardent. And I couldn't allow myself to be ardent, and I didn't feel it fully. But to the degree I became ardent with my wife, it made my homosexual responses more ardent. And I've heard psychotherapists say that it's like two sides of a timber. If you raise a timber or a tree or whatever you want to pull, whatever you want to describe, you're raising both sides of it. And if you are attracted to both males and females, mm-hmm. experiencing one side is going to influence you to want the other. Mm-hmm. And people who are at the Kinsey extremes, the zero for zero homosexual response or behavior, or the six, this isn't much of a problem for them. But for people who can experience both, somewhere in that middling area, it can allow homosexually inclined males and females to marry and, quote, be successful by having children and having sexual relations, but it increases, at least by my experience and the experience of hundreds that I've spoken with, it increases the desire for the forbidden and the need for the forbidden, and it creates a living hell. And so that's, I was going through that at this point with my wife, and so that was another reason I wanted, it wasn't just I wanted to be rid of aspiring for church office, the phrase that's kind of a cliche in Mormonism. I also just wanted to be free of the delusion, which is how I regarded it, that I, as a unhappily married, loving husband, father of children, with my loving wife unhappily married to me, could even think of being an apostle. And so that's why I went to him. But the outcome wasn't what I expected when he asked me if I wanted the blessing, and I said yes, and I expected him to bless me to overcome my desires, and he instead blessed me that that blessing and that promise and that expectation would be fulfilled.
You didn't talk to him about your homosexuality?
No. Again, because I hadn't done anything. And I knew he had a blind spot about homosexuality, and I just didn't want to invite problems.
Sure.
And that, you know, that you could say that's cowardice, that's withholding unnecessary information. And yes, it was both of those things. But at the time, I didn't feel that I should be subject myself to all kinds of problems merely because I was being tempted. I hadn't done anything. And so that was the approach I took.
Was it hard to not have that taken away by God?
By not, you mean the expectation?
Was it, no, sorry. Was it hard to not have the feelings of same-sex attraction taken away?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You prayed, I assume you prayed.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a terrible experience.
Is that one of those fist-shaking moments?
No, it wasn't that, and I don't know exactly why, because I know I've met many Mormon-raised gay men who have been devastated in their faith. But typically the response from them that I heard and my own was that you're not good enough, that somehow it's your fault, and that you don't have faith enough and you're not trying enough. And that's usually the message, rather than this is who you are and deal with it, because God is dealing with it. And that, I wish, had been a message that I'd gotten as a kid. But even psychiatrists and gay authors, novelists like James Baldwin, were presenting a very dark, negative view of homosexual relations and homosexuality. So I was a product of my generation and the worldview in which I was raised, and in which even out gay men were living their lives in a form of internalized homophobia and self-hatred and self-loathing. And so that just was part of the package that I grew up with.
This question may fit a little better later when we talk about the September 6th stuff, but when I was at BYU in 1993, I remember hearing about September 6th, and I was kind of bothered. And this is going to be a little bit of a tough question, but I want to share it with you for an opportunity to either dispel it or provide perspective or deny it or whatever. But I was talking to a family member who is an employee of BYU, and I was just kind of saying, man, the September 6th thing is a bummer, and I don't like it, and kind of bothers me, and why should the church be excommunicating people just for being good historians like Michael Quinn? I don't get it. And what he said to me was, one of the advantages people who are excommunicated have over the church leaders who have to perform excommunications is that the people being excommunicated can talk about it, but the leaders can't. And he said there were other reasons that people were excommunicated besides writing history. And what he was inferring, or what he actually explicitly said, was that, you know, well, Michael Quinn was gay and he was perusing the bars of Provo and seducing young men. I don't know what he was saying, but that was, you know, that was what he laid on me. And I'm like, oh my gosh, the world's more complex than I thought. You know.
Yeah. No, and yes. The common assumption in Mormon society is that people, particularly 20th century, is that people aren't excommunicated for apostasy. They're only excommunicated for sex. And that has been a kind of enduring folk belief. And I participated in that myself, in the sense that when I heard that somebody in my stake was excommunicated, it was, well, what did she do? Or what did he do? I mean, the assumption is it's behavior. And that's ingrained, and many people will not abandon that no matter what. The advantage that I had in my side of the story is that the stake president began the process with a letter where he outlined why he was going to and be investigating me for a disciplinary court. And the letter outlined evidences of my apostasy, and they were everything that I'd published or said to the newspapers during the past year. So the three specific examples he gave was my article in 1992 about women in the priesthood, published in the book Women in Authority by Maxine Hanks,
who's right also, there in the back,
who was also excommunicated the same month I was. The other example that he gave in the letter was my article in Sunstone about 150 years of truth and consequences in Mormon history, showing the tension between the leadership and those who disclosed uncomfortable facts about the past and how that tension had worked out very often in excommunication. And the third example he gave, which showed that he had no sense of irony, was my statement to the newspapers that the 19th century church accepted diversity and a loyal opposition, and the 20th century church did not accept a loyal opposition and wanted cookie-cutter Mormons instead. Anyway, he had written this and signed it, and he didn't expect that I was not going to lie down quickly and roll over and say, you know, kick me again. And so instead, I was on my way to California before he even came to my door, and I had a three-month fellowship with the Huntington Library there. And so before I took off, I went to the AP reporter that I knew, and I went to Peggy Fletcher Stack in the Salt Lake Tribune, and I gave them copies of this letter. And I gave them a copy of the response that I wrote to him and mailed to him. And then I went off to California, and this ended up in the Salt Lake Tribune, and it ended up as an AP wire story, which was published in the LA Times. So the short answer is that this began as an accusation of apostasy over my publications, and including my being quoted by the media. And throughout the months that this dragged on, when the stake president of the Salt Lake Stake kept knocking on my door or writing me letters or phoning me saying he wanted me to come in and subject myself to an interview, I just said, I'm not playing this game. I've been through this before. I know you're under orders from church headquarters, despite what you say, and I'm not going to participate in a kangaroo court. And I'm not going to participate in my own intimidation. So I refuse to meet with you, and I'll acknowledge your letters, but don't expect me to do any more. And he made it clear that he wanted a kind of a fishing expedition approach to my whole life, but I just said, I'm not going to talk with you about anything, and so it doesn't matter what you think. And in the final letter that I got announcing my excommunication, it specified, and this also Levina had access to and referred to in the essay she wrote about me in a book called Mormon Mavericks, the statement specified that I was excommunicated for conduct unbecoming a church member in my refusal to cooperate with the stake president. That was it. And the weird thing was that apostasy wasn't even in there anymore.
Nor was homosexuality.
And they define my conduct unbecoming as my refusal to cooperate with the stake president, which I'd stated from the beginning, from February on. This was in September. And the strange thing was that my historical writings on apostasy dropped out of the announcement of the reasons for my excommunication in the official letter I received. I received a backstory from somebody who was at the meeting that...
You didn't attend your excommunication?
No, I didn't. I told him I would not. But somebody who was there said that the discussion in the High Council was over whether my statements, my recorded statements at Sunstone, my publications actually did constitute apostasy. And there was a split in the High Council. And some said it did, and some said it didn't. Mm. And at that point, the person who was there was dismissed from the meeting. And my read of the situation was that the reason it was no longer mentioned, even though this is what started it, in his initial letter to me, was that there was no unanimous vote on my publications constituting apostasy. And so the thing he could get a unanimous vote on, about which there was no dispute, and which I had acknowledged verbally and in every letter I'd written him, was that I refused to cooperate with him. And for that, I could be accused, as I was, of insubordination.
And you came out as gay when?
Didn't come out as gay until 3 years later.
96?
Mm-hmm, when I published the same-sex book. And I knew that in writing that and publishing it, I would get specific questions from people of all different backgrounds about my motives for writing it and my sexual orientation. And so I knew that would out me. But I was ready for it at that point. I still didn't take out billboard signs, but the fact remains that in 1996, with the publication of the book, I was out as a gay man.
Okay. Well, I want to jump back a little bit now, because we haven't talked about your years in the Arrington administration. And I guess when I first started reading the Power series, the two books on power, Origins and Extensions of Power, I was kind of trying to envision you in the 70s and what you were doing. And what I envisioned was this man who, as quietly as he could, would go into church archives and just be like hand copying or photocopying as many possible journals and diaries and records as he could, so that over a 10-year period he could amass this massive collection of records, so that then he could, you know, write a bunch of books on whatever topics you wanted. But I'm just curious, like, is that kind of what you were doing? And what was driving you to collect so much information?
Well, when I started, I was a graduate student at BYU, hired by Davis Bitten, who was my advisor and a professor at BYU, to be his chief research assistant, which was a title he gave me. Even though he'd hired others before me, I was the one who was going to be the chief one. And I was to do research and diaries at the church archives. And that was my part-time job for that year, from April 1973 until December, when his money ran out. And he could no longer hire me to do that. Well, when I asked him what he wanted me to write, he told me that there were certain things he was really interested in. He was really interested in dreams or visions that people might record in their autobiographies or their diaries. And I said, well, what else besides that? And do you just want me? And he said, no, anything you think is interesting wrong thing to say to me. Because, for example, when I got the Heber J. Grant diaries and went through them, I handed him 200 pages of single-space typed notes. And his eyes just rolled back, and he said, "This is for one diary? Or one set of diaries, one person's diaries?" And I said, "Yes, because it's so interesting." And I, you know, and it's interesting to me, and I thought it would be interesting to you. But if, you know, read it over, look it over, and if you don't want me to do this anymore, then, you know, then I won't. And he came back to me the next day and just said, "Keep it up, keep doing it." And so I would give him the original copy of what I typed, and I kept carbons. And I told him, I asked him if that would be all right for me to do that, and he said yes. And he was my advisor as a graduate student, and he knew that I was interested in Mormon history, and so that's what I did. And I just took notes on anything that interested me, anything that was new or sensational or controversial, or I thought, wow, that's interesting, whether it's a vision that the person has or a dream of seeing Jesus, or they're smoking on tobacco because the first presidency told them to because they were a nervous type, which was James E. Talmadge's experience. The first presidency commanded him to smoke tobacco to unwind because he was wound up too tightly. No matter what it was, if it was doctrinal, if it was something about church administration where, like, ward members would vote against a bishop that had been given to them by the visiting apostles, and the apostles would say, "Well, who do you want?" These kinds of things that were not my own experience, especially, I wrote down all, and I took detailed notes. I didn't summarize. I took verbatim notes of these various entries. And I continued that for 15 years of research in church archives.
15 years. 15. Like a kid in a candy store.
Pardon?
Like a kid in a candy
store.
Yeah,
very much. And yet, I started out totally independent. I was an employee of a professor when I started doing this. And then in December, when my job with Davis Bitten ended, Leonard invited me to be his research assistant in Salt Lake, because his former research assistant in Salt Lake, who had introduced us, Dick Bennett, was going to Canada for a PhD program there. And so that left Leonard without a research assistant at Church Archives, and he hired me. And then 2 months later, I got a phone call from him, and he said that he had been invited by the First Presidency to be the official church historian, and he wanted to hire me as the first member of his staff.
What was he like?
He was wonderful. Leonard was this Idaho potato farmer who remained as down-to-earth his whole life, despite a PhD from Duke University and being the president of the Western History Association and this sterling professor of economics and history at USU, Utah State University. He always maintained that down-to-earth, dirt-under-my-fingernails kind of personality and back-slapping kind of guy. He was just so disarming and so wonderful to work with as a boss that I really can't sing his praises enough. However, of the people who joined after he was appointed church historian, and I had my interview with Alvin R. Dyer, who at that time was the managing director. That was in February. Of the ones who were being hired from that point forward, I was the first to leave. I ended my work with Leonard on his staff in August of 1993. So I was there only about 18 months. And when I came back as an independent researcher.
Not 93. What year?
Oh, pardon me. 1973.
Okay,
excuse me. 1973. Sorry. So it started in interviewed in February 1972. My official starting date was March 1972. And in August 1973, I ended my employment there to go to Yale. Now, I wanted to go back on his staff, and Leonard wanted me to go back on his staff, but it just never worked out, because when he had available slots to hire people, I was still at Yale and couldn't go full-time, and so he hired other people, and when I was available after I was almost done with my dissertation and then got my degree and I was available, he had no slot.
So you didn't work under him after your PhD?
No, I was never. I often went back on what he called fellowships that he provided out of money that he received as royalties for things that he published, and that Davis Bitton and James Allen, his assistants, published. They voluntarily turned their royalties, their personal royalties, into what they called the Mormon History Trust Fund. And from that, they, Leonard, would, with their advice and consent, would give fellowships to people to do research on particular topics. And I would get those, but that was my only even formal connection with Leonard from that time forward. Okay. After that, I was a graduate student at Yale, then I was a professor at BYU, and never was in his employ again.
Many will know that those years were kind of called the Camelot years of church history, from, what, 72 to 82, something like that?
Yes.
Did you feel that excitement?
Oh, yes.
What was that like, and what was it like to see
it all
fall
down? Leonard was this expansive person. I mean, his personality was just expansive and positive, and he had this, and he had reason for it, because the first presidency had approved these various recommendations he made for the things that he thought the church history division and the historical department as a whole should do for outreach to the Mormon community as well as to the non-Mormon community. And the first presidency had approved all of these proposals. And so he had the justifiable expectation that things would just get better and better and better. And for a while, they did. But then within about 4 years, things began reversing. And he found that the first presidency, when he was criticized, or he learned that he was criticized by members of the 12, the first presidency didn't inform them that they had already approved these things that Leonard was being criticized for. And understandably, Spencer W. Kimball had other things, many other things, that were far more important to him than history. He didn't feel threatened by history. It wasn't his thing either. And Leonard's appointment had occurred under President Kimball's predecessor, who was predecessors, first in January of 1972, Joseph Fielding Smith was the president when he received the initial call as church historian. And then after that July, then Harold B. Lee was president when things really were starting to move after Leonard had been a church historian, the official sustained church historian for about 3 months. And then after Harold B. Lee's unexpected death, Spencer W. Kimball became president, and while he was interested in history in a kind of a informal way, it was not a consuming interest for him, and he just had other things that understandably kept his attention, and Leonard's priorities kind of fell through the cracks, and with apostles who considered Leonard uppity at the back of the church bus, this was not good for a president to no longer be one he could turn to for these kinds of decisions that he'd gotten when Harold B. Lee was in the first presidency.
Ezra Taft Benson, Bruce L. McConkie?
No.
No?
Ezra Taft Benson, Mark E. Peterson, and Boyd K. Packer. were the three who all shared a suspicion of what was going on in the historical department, and misgivings about Leonard's appointment from the get-go. And as time progressed and more publications were coming out by both non-Mormons and Mormons, based scholars, based on the research that they had done, which Leonard hadn't allowed them to do. It would have been initially Howard W. Hunter and then the archivist Earl Olson, who had granted access to materials. But Leonard had been the driving force for historians learning about this ability to do the research. And he'd been encouraging them to come as a part of the outreach that he felt he had First Presidency approval for. And so he became the fall guy in this Greek drama. And the apostles blamed him for everyone who was disturbed or upset or embarrassed about something they read that was based on research done since 1972. Mm.
And so it fell. Do you remember talking to Leonard about the fall after it fell and what it did to him or how it made him feel?
Well, even before he was, and this is in 1977, when he was still the official church historian, he said that a man who's received a calling from the First Presidency ought to be allowed to function in that calling and to do what he was commissioned to do. And if they don't approve of it, then release him. That was Leonard's statement to me in October 1977. So he was feeling the pressure then. And was very unhappy at that point. And that is earlier than most people recognize that he was under that kind of pressure. But he expressed that to me. And he was not a person to confide. He kept his cards very close to the vest. And that was one of the very few times that he expressed his feelings of frustration with his position. And I didn't express that to anyone else. And Leonard is now long dead, and I feel I can talk about it.
Talk briefly about your interview with Boyd K. Packer. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to think that you would go to BYU and that BYU would hire you after all of this. But maybe talk briefly about your interview with Boyd K. Packer.
Well, that was not pleasant news when I learned that he was going to be the general authority to interview me. And I prayed a lot, nonstop, in fact, from the day, the afternoon when I was told that he was going to be interviewing me to the next day when I had the interview. The interview lasted about 45 minutes, but aside from maybe 3 minutes, it was all a lecture by Boyd Packer, or asking me questions about history. It wasn't an interview, not in the sense that I had expected it anyway. And he started out by saying that he had a hard time with historians because historians idolized the truth. And it went downhill from there. And I repeatedly, every time he would ask me this leading question about, well, what would you do if you found this in a diary and you were writing a biography of this man? And I tried in my, you know, to talk about putting things in context, and it's, you know, it's a decision whether you put something in a footnote or whether you devote a sentence to it or a paragraph or a whole chapter. It depends on your reading of the significance of the controversy or whatever. But he just kept shaking his head that he obviously did not agree with me. And at the end of the interview, he said, well, I'll put on the form that you are worthy of being hired by BYU. But it was very clear that he did not think I should belong there, that I should go there, because he didn't like historians, particularly of my persuasion. And my view of telling the truth in context, et cetera, that didn't go anywhere with him.
Hmm. Yet, I remember you saying that you were not only hired by BYU, but you were able to achieve the equivalent of tenure and that he didn't oppose that, or at least you have no evidence.
Well, I don't know that he opposed it or supported it. I don't know.
But he certainly didn't keep that from happening.
He didn't keep it from happening, and I was promoted up the ranks quite quickly at BYU, and all those decisions of promotion had to be finalized by the Board of Trustees, of which he was a member. But that's all I can say. I don't know if those meetings, I don't know if they require unanimous votes. Nearly everything else does. Mm-hmm. I would think it requires unanimous vote. But I don't know. The fact remains that while he was on the Board of Trustees, I was promoted and eventually received BYU's equivalent of tenure.
I'm going to refer listeners and you guys to an interview that Martha Sontag Bradley did with Michael Quinn in 1995, where they talk about his time at BYU, what type of mentor he was to the historians there, what his experiences were. It's a really wonderful thing to listen to, and what it meant for Michael to raise young historians. We're going to skip that tonight, but I don't want to skip. And also, it talks about some of the publications and writings that he did that led up to an interview, an interesting interview with the state president. But I do want to have you, so we're going to sort of say you had a great career at BYU, you mentored a lot of students, did some great scholarly work, and then you got a call from your state president. And I'd love to hear that story.
Date.
Pardon?
Date.
Date of the
date.
Interview.
1985. In the spring, in April, Dialogue came out with a nearly 100-page article that I had written, published on plural marriage after the manifesto, and it was titled LDS Church Authority and New Plural Marriages, 1890 to 1904. And after giving a historical background to the manifesto, I looked at each member of the first presidency from then till 1904 and how they responded to the issue of the manifesto, and demonstrated from archival documents and diaries and other sources, written sources, that the first presidency almost, well, to a man, had given encouragement, had authorized plural marriages, had authorized the officiators of plural marriages, had in some cases performed plural marriages. Well, I got a call in the month after that from my stake president, who said he needed to talk with me. So he did, and he told me that he had had a 2.5-hour meeting with our area president, who was Hugh Pinnock at that point. And, not Pinnock. No, not Pinnock. Paramore. James Paramore was our area president at that time. And the state president said that the upshot of the meeting was that President Pinnock had told my state president and his two counselors at this meeting that three apostles had given Elder Pinnock instructions to have this meeting with the stake president and to inform the stake president that the apostles regarded my article and dialogue as speaking evil of the Lord's anointed, and that I should have my temple recommend immediately re-yanked, and that if that did not keep me from doing Mormon history, then he should take further action against me. Well, the stake president told me this and then told me that he had a 2.5-hour argument with James Paramore over this matter, which was not what Elder Paramore was expecting. And my stake president and both his counselors, one of whom had been my bishop when I was the bishop's counselor, the other of whom was a son of Gordon B. Hinckley, and those three had spent 2.5 hours arguing with Elder Paramore that this was inappropriate, that there was nothing in the article which all of them had read that they regarded as apostate or as speaking evil of the Lord's anointed, that instead I was dealing with a difficult period of time in Mormon history and laying it out as best I could, and they said that they had enjoyed the article. And Elder Paramore was not prepared for that response, and said that he had his instructions to get the affirmation from the stake president that he was going to take my temple recommend. And the stake president said that he did not regard that as justifiable, but he would meet with me and discuss with me. And he said, and of course, I'm going to talk about our meeting that we've had for the last 2.5 hours. And Elder Paramore said, oh, no, you can't do that. You've got to tell him that this is your idea. You can't say that this came from me or from apostles. This was your concern about the article. And my stake president said, Elder Paramore, you have two choices. Either I do nothing and I say nothing to him, or I tell him the truth.
He's another truth idolizer.
Right. And wasn't an academic. He was an insurance executive. So anyway, he lays this out for me, and my former bishop, who was his counselor, his second counselor, did as well. I wasn't as well acquainted with Richard Hinckley, who was the first counselor, but I had known him, I'd spoken in his ward a number of times as a high council representative, and so he knew me, and said that he had read the article, although I had given a copy of it to my bishop before the change in the bishopric had occurred quite recently. Anyway, so the article came out, and the stake president explained the situation. And he said, Mike, I feel I have to do something. I've told you everything that has transpired, but he said, I feel that I have to take your temple recommend to do something that they've asked me to do, but I will not go the other step, and I will not do anything further. But he said, I'm his insurance executive, and I'm not going to try to tell you how to do history, but please find some way to do history without these conflicts with the brethren. And I said I would do my best to do that, but I didn't know how I could do both at the same time. And so that was where we left it. He told me that he thought the requirement of taking my temple recommend was a backdoor effort to have me fired at BYU. So he told me specifically, if anyone at BYU asks if you have a temple recommend, tell them that you do. And if they want any further information, give them my name and telephone number. And don't volunteer that your temple recommend is in my desk drawer. And when it expires, I'll renew it. And all I will say to anyone who asks is that you have a valid temple recommend. And that's where it remained for the next 3 years until I left BYU.
It's a fun story. I'd love to meet that man. I'd shake his hand. Why did you resign from BYU? Why didn't you make them fire you or make a big stink about it? Why didn't you stick around?
Well, contrary to what many people think, I don't run to the newspapers, with the exception of this effort to 1993 when I did with the letter from the stake president. But I speak to the media only when they speak to me and when they ask me to respond to something, and then I'll answer their questions as best they can. And as many people might be surprised to know, I do not like conflict. I dislike it intensely. And by the time the book was published, Magic Worldview, was published in August 1987, I was sick of conflict, and it just intensified after its publication. And I knew I was dead meat at BYU. I knew if I had just inadvertently moved out of our stake after my wife and I separated and divorced, that I would have been in a stake where the stake president didn't know me, and he would just immediately have done what Elder Paramore had asked him to do. And so if I moved to another stake or a new stake president came who wasn't as uppity as this one, I was dead meat in the church. And so I wanted to leave BYU on my own terms. I didn't want to be kicked out. And so I began making inquiries about other places I could go, other positions I might go to, and I got a wonderful offer from a man who became my next mentor. His name was Ridge, Martin Ridge. He was a professor of history, Western American history, at Caltech University, and he was also head of the research department at the Huntington Library near Caltech. And he offered me a total of a year and a half of fellowships full-time to allow me to leave BYU if I wanted to. And this was like a manna from heaven. And as soon as I got his telephone offer, before it was in writing to me in the mail, I sat down and started typing a letter of resignation from BYU. But because the term had already begun, I made it effective as of the end of that term, which was May. And so that's why I resigned. I did not want to be pushed out. I didn't want to go through any more of the pressure. I was having students come to me and telling me that they were changing their major from history because their teachers were criticizing me in class, in religion class, and one of them said, "Mike, I don't want to end up like you. The church is my life." And that honesty hurt. Honesty hurts. I mean, I recognize that. But I appreciated that student's point of view. I understood why he took that point of view and why he was changing his major, even though he'd taken every course I offered. And I just didn't want to experience any more of that.
Did you ever imagine it would be your last university position?
I thought it might be because I had told others that BYU was a dead end, that once you were there, it was very difficult to get hired elsewhere because of the low reputation that BYU had academically in the nation. And people at BYU will be infuriated to hear me say that, but that was the essential common view of all the professors at BYU while I was there from 1976 to 1988, is that you can get into BYU and they may hire you for more than you could get at another university, but leaving BYU and being hired by another university is almost impossible.
Especially in the humanities.
Especially in the humanities with the job market. So even though I hoped, I did not hold out a lot of hope, but nonetheless I had hope. By 2003, I no longer had hope. By the time that I was denied two positions for which I was the only candidate.
Where?
University of Utah and Arizona State University. Then I
both
just decided
with LDS there, administrators, donors, funders, well, it was, state legislatures.
Yeah, yeah. And with the Arizona State situation, it was different. One of their major donors said, "I understand you're inviting Michael Quinn to be a faculty member. Is he more important than a $100 million donation?" Dead silence. And the provost understandably canceled the decision of the Department of Religious Studies and of two deans and a chair of religious studies and countermanded the decision to hire me.
What's it like to be a distinguished historian, graduate of Yale University, and not able to get a job?
Yeah, can't get no respect. Me and Rodney Dangerfield. It's painful, but my mission president, Marion D. Hanks, whose funeral I'm going to be attending tomorrow, was an inspiration to me in many ways. One of my several mentors of great significance. And when he was a missionary, he said, "When you pick up one end of the stick, you end up picking up the other end too." And I thought of that a lot, even though he was talking about it in relation to other things and being a good missionary and all of that. I thought about it, that I had picked up this stick of Mormon history and I had to live with the consequences of what I had engaged in and what I had refused to retreat from. And so while I was hurt, disappointed, unhappy, I recognized that these were the consequences of decisions that I had started making when I was 17, and asked LeGrand Richards about Adam God and plural marriage after the manifesto, and had continued with my intensive research from that point and beyond my expectations of publishing, which I had not expected to do, about these problem areas. So I had picked up the other end of the stick, and I have to acknowledge that, and I did at the time.
Okay. Jumping now forward to the September 6th really quickly, I want to refer those of you who get a chance, I think there's a book chapter that was written telling your story. It talks about sort of how you almost tried to live in hiding to avoid excommunication for many years, went to New Orleans and other places. We won't tell those stories here, but just talk briefly about, I guess, how it felt to be excommunicated and what that did to you.
Well, this isn't true of everyone. I know people who've been excommunicated and who've been thrilled about it, and or have been indifferent, who couldn't care, like some of these boys in England who thought they were joining a baseball club and found out they were in a church, and being excommunicated didn't mean much, except no one likes to be kicked out of anything. But aside from that, they were rather indifferent. And I've known even generational Mormons with pioneer ancestry, who have not, for some reason, been deeply connected to Mormonism. And so leaving the church was not a problem for them. Being excommunicated or asking to have their membership removed, not a problem. For me, it was huge. And it was something that I had dreaded, something I had tried to avoid. And when I've explained it to non-Mormons, I've said it's hard for you to understand, but it's like dying and attending your own funeral. It's that visceral kind of loss that you're grieving your own death, and your membership has gone and been taken away, and it is like a death in the family. And that's the easiest way I can describe it, except it's your own death. And you're aware of it, and you're going through the process of grieving. So it's that usually didn't help my non-Mormon friends or reporters to understand it, because they thought the explanation was as weird as they regarded Mormonism anyway. But that's how I regarded it. It was like dying. But the one thing I did not expect, which was a total surprise to me, was the profound sense of relief I felt. I was no longer hiding. I was no longer in fear of Damocles' sword dropping, or the guillotine, or whatever symbol you want to use. And I no longer felt that I had to, in any degree, defend policies of the church that I disagreed with. And I had really, over the years, particularly from the ERA campaign of the church in the late 1970s onward, had just held my tongue about things that did not immediately involve what I was, and that was a historian of Mormon history. And otherwise, I kept all of my reservations to myself and didn't even confide them to very many of my liberal friends, particularly the ERA issue. I just didn't express my opposition to what was going on. And my excommunication relieved me of that obligation. I no longer had to defend the church as a, quote, loyal member. I no longer had to remain silent about things I absolutely thought were reprehensible. And that was enormous. And I no longer had to hide or be worried. What I'd been afraid of had happened. And I wasn't prepared for that sense of relief that I felt.
Any desire to come back?
No. No.
Still the one true church, but don't want to join.
Yeah, it's the one true church, but I'm an aardvark or a duck-billed platypus of Mormonism. I've always been sort of a church of one. And when I said that when I was a teenager and decided to live a straight life, and my attitude was, it's just you and me, Lord. Well, throughout my life, my relationship spiritually was very much that way. The church was always secondary to my relationship with God. And I'd always test other issues of loyalty in the church with how I felt about it spiritually with God. And I don't believe that baptism or any other ordinance, in fact, this is frequently taught, that no ordinance is valid unless it's ratified by the Holy Spirit of promise. Well, this isn't said, but excommunication is an ordinance, and that cannot be ratified and valid eternally unless it's ratified by the Holy Spirit of promise, and I don't think mine was. I trust in my relationship with God, and it's a very private relationship. I've attended other fellowships, Quaker and Anglican and the gay and lesbian fellowship that is available. And I just haven't felt at home anywhere. And if I can't go to the church and partake of the sacrament, which for me is the only reason to go to church, then I don't want to go to church. And so I don't go. And the remarkable thing to me is that I've never missed not going. And that is strange to me because from the time I was a teenager, I was 100% attender, except in MIA when I went inactive for a few years. But aside from MIA, I was 100% as a teenager in all my meetings. And for me to wake up on a Sunday morning after I'd stopped going to church and not miss it is really quite extraordinary. But having not attended for 5 years, because I didn't want to be identified and tracked down and excommunicated, once I knew they were after me and I was going to be excommunicated in 1993, when I was in Los Angeles, I went every Sunday to LDS Church because I knew that was the last opportunity I would have to partake of the sacrament as a member of the church and to speak and to bear my testimony, which I did. But it was a last hurrah. And I was in a ward where the bishop was very supportive, and he commented about the LA Times article about my situation. He said, "What's wrong with those people in Utah?" And he invited me to give a fireside to his ward on women in the priesthood. So it was a great ward. It was an unusual ward. And so participating in it every week that 3 months was great.
You got some good leaders. Mm-hmm. All right, it's time for a lightning round. We're kind of out of time, but there's some questions I have to ask. So I'm going to give you the challenge to answer as briefly as possible.
Okay.
1 to 3 word answers are fine if that's appropriate for the question. All right?
All right.
You ready? Some will be a little longer, but let's see.
I don't promise, but okay. I'm ready.
Do what you can. Favorite book that you've written?
What?
Favorite book that you've written?
Oh, favorite book that I've written. Magic Worldview.
Why?
It demanded the most of me. It demanded me to go beyond my comfort area in terms of my academic background. It required me to submerge myself in a worldview that was in many ways alien to my own in order to understand a worldview that was familiar to Joseph Smith. And because of that stretching of my research and my world perspective, and my spiritual perspective, it was my favorite.
Okay, that was good. That was good, pretty short.
Not 3 words.
No, that was a longer question. What are the biggest and most important, name the top five discrepancies in terms of what the general membership think about church history and what the actual historical record shows, the most significant or disturbing or important ones that if you could have kind of straighten the story out, what would be the ones that you would say, we got to get straight on these things?
The first is that the experience of Joseph Smith in seeing God and Jesus Christ in the Sacred Grove was an unparalleled experience that no one else claimed. It was very common in published conversion narratives of Protestants who'd converted at the same kind of revival meetings that Joseph Smith had attended. Very common. Ministers frequently would write, sometimes decades after their vision, they would write this as a part of describing their spiritual journey. So that's the first one, to think that that Joseph Smith was unique in having that experience or making that claim in the 1820s. Another one is the claim that Mormonism is unique, this idea that a restored church can have only one similarity, and that is to the ancient church. Well, in many ways, it bears no similarities to the ancient church. We have ordinances, we have officers that are not mentioned in the New Testament. We have doctrines that are not taught in the New Testament. So there's a great deal that we do not resemble in the early Christian church. And there are other churches that we do resemble. Many characteristics of early Mormonism were adopted from Methodism, which Brigham Young, Joseph Smith, and other leaders of the church were familiar with, and they incorporated those kinds of things in Mormonism. So Joseph Smith's first vision was not a unique claim. Now, what emanated from that vision, very unique in America in particular, but the claim itself, not unique. Mormonism, the LDS Church, peculiar in its own ways, but similar in other ways to both ancient Christianity as well as other contemporary Protestant churches. Another is that the Mormons were always persecuted because people are hateful, and it was irrational, and there was no basis for it. As appealing as the martyr syndrome is, for anyone who's been picked on at a personal level or any group historically, usually it's more complex than that. Yes, there were people who hated Mormonism because there was an open canon, because Joseph Smith claimed there was a book that had the status of the Bible. Yes, people hated Mormons because Joseph Smith ultimately claimed that there was, in print, that he'd had this first vision of God and Jesus. But there was persecution also because Mormons contributed to the environment that encouraged their neighbors to regard them as enemies. So persecution was not just one-sided. It was not totally irrational, and it was not without some motivation on the part of Mormons themselves. Another is that Joseph Smith had only one intent for his succession after his death, and that was obviously Brigham Young and the Quorum of the Twelve. In fact, he had established 8 different legitimate paths for succeeding him, and he never sorted out which had priority over the other, which threw the church into chaos. Brigham Young indeed had a legitimate claim, but there were other claimants who could also argue that their claim was legitimate on the basis of Joseph Smith. So those are the 5.
All right, that's very good. Personal heroes within Mormonism, name the top heroes for you.
Flawed heroes. Joseph Smith, deeply flawed. A prophet of God who spoke with God face to face, my absolute conviction, but one who had a difficult and in some ways tormented childhood, had a adolescence that wasn't easy, and was not easy as a husband to deal with for Emma. A very human being, but nonetheless one who talked with God and who received inspiration in various ways. My first hero, Brigham Young, my second. Not a person you would want to cross in a dark alley. But he was the savior for the existence of the LDS Church. If it hadn't been for a leader like Brigham Young, it would have been very easy for the song that Mormons sang, "I do not want a church without a prophet. A church without a prophet is not for me." That's what early Mormons sang. And suddenly the church no longer had a prophet. And if Brigham Young hadn't been the decisive, a powerful leader that he was, the church would have disintegrated with all of these legitimate avenues that Joseph Smith had established for replacing him, there would have been no Mormonism in 1854, even maybe, but definitely by 1860, not in the kind of cohesive way that Brigham Young created in the in the valleys. Next hero, Wilford Woodruff. Pardon me.
We've been having you talk quite a bit today. You've been a good sport.
I choked on my own spit. I wasn't just talking. Wilford Woodruff had warned that if the church gave up polygamy, it would no longer be God's church. He'd said that publicly. It had been printed in the Journal of Discourses, in the Deseret News. And yet, when he was faced with the utter destruction of the church, he did what anyone who loved the culture and loved the church more than they loved the principles would do. And that was, he was willing to sacrifice a principle and its practice in order to save the vehicle through which the principle was communicated. Now, all the principles were communicated to the world. So he was flawed, yes. Wilford Woodruff was human, as all of the prophets are, from Adam to Abraham to Moses to Peter, Paul. But he bit the bullet in a way that subjected him to a tremendous amount of criticism within the church and a tremendous amount of praise from people he could barely stand to acknowledge, people he regarded as evildoers. Praised him for something that he did only because they forced him into it. Tremendous admiration for him. David O. McKay was the prophet I grew up with, even though George Albert Smith dedicated the chapel that I worshiped in and dedicated it when I was about, would have been six years old, almost 6 years old. David O. McKay was the prophet I really remembered, and he had this appearance that even non-Mormons looked at him and felt impressed that somehow this was a man of God. And he was flawed, definitely a flawed person, something I didn't realize until I did research into his time period, which I vowed I never would, because I never wanted to research anything in the contemporary history. I always wanted to stop it at 1830 or 32 when I expanded my study into the hierarchy. I still wanted it to not include anybody that was leading the church during my lifetime. But I ended up getting this assignment to write a biography of J. Reuben Clark, and in the process, I found that Clark was also a great man who was deeply flawed, and that David O. McKay had his own flaws. And that just deepened my appreciation for the humanity of all the prophets, even one like David O. McKay, whom I idolized from childhood. And I wrote him when I was 10. I wrote him a letter because he was coming down to near our stake, and I wrote him a letter inviting him over to our house for pancakes. So that's somewhere in the files, which didn't do me any good later and when I needed help, but nonetheless I made that generous offer on behalf of my family. One I didn't know. I did not have a personal association with either of the Bunyans, Adam S. Bunyan, who was an apostle, or Lowell Bunyan. I was thinking of another word, another name for some reason. But I read what both of those men wrote, who were, I think, cousins, an apostle, one an apostle, the other a teacher in the seminary and institute program. And they spoke to the kind of Mormonism I understood from my readings and hearing of David O. McKay, of Hugh B. Brown. These were deeply personal views of Mormonism, not as an institution, but as a family. And that having the obligations to God's children throughout the world, of any family, to reach out to those children who are not recognized as being part of the family and to try to encourage them to enter the fold of the family. And those teachings by Adam S. Bennion and Lowell Bennion, David O. McKay, Hugh B. Brown, they were my heroes. And then Leonard Arrington, who I've expressed already my great admiration for. Leonard was not the kind of radical historian that I became. And even as a new member of his staff, he had to rein me in. I received from Leonard nothing but encouragement. And every time I published something, he would send me a letter, this is something I should do, but I haven't to any of my colleagues over the years. Very rarely have I done this. But he would, every time I published something, every time I gave a talk that he had heard, he wrote letters of congratulations and support to me. And after my excommunication, he was one of my devout and continued friends, and he just remained a true friend, even though he would not have gone as far as I did in many respects. He was more conservative as a historian, as an interpreter than I. But despite that difference, and despite sometimes shaking his head, as I'm sure he did, about some of the things I wrote and said, he nonetheless remained my mentor and my friend, and so I deeply admire him as a hero, not only to me, but I think a hero of modern Mormonism. I think I regard him as Mormonism's greatest historian.
Give us, without explaining, just for the sake of time, give us three women that you would throw in there.
Emma Smith. Well, boy, what she had to put up with Joseph. Not only from the outside in terms of having him and their children terrorized in 1832, but also the problems that she had with him as a charismatic. Every charismatic is difficult to understand by people closest to that charismatic, man or woman, charismatic man or woman. And Joseph had those problems, plus the problems he introduced by living plural marriage, usually without the knowledge of his wife. And so that her courage and maintaining her devotion to him and her devotion to Mormonism, even though she split with Brigham Young, and that I think was regrettable, it was almost inevitable and certainly understandable. She's one of my great heroines. I'd say Emmeline B. Wells, great Mormon feminist of the 19th century,
okay.
Great, powerful woman on her own, in her own right. And then more to the present, I'd say Florence Smith Jacobson, who as a director of the Church Historic Sites once told the First Presidency that they would tear down a building over her dead body. And she meant it. And for her to be that uppity at the back of the church bus, I have enormous admiration for her.
Thank you. Three last questions. The first is your third book in the series. A lot of people are asking about it. Can you just tell us quickly what its topic is and when we can expect it to be out?
Well, it's kind of changed over time, because I've been working on this for ages, and people are hearing me, tired of hearing me, those I've talked to about it. But now, as I, in its most recent definition, that I think is the definition that will remain in place, is that I'm studying the Mormon hierarchy with reference to LDS business and finance from 1830 to 2010.
Okay. And
that's
it. You think it might be out?
Whenever I get the damn thing done.
Okay. Maybe 2012, maybe?
Oh, no, not that early. I might get it finished in 2012. I'm aiming for January. I would like, but I have to plug into the publisher's lineup of books that are maybe even better than my proposal, and so we'll see when it gets out in print.
Okay. So a 30-year-old male comes to you and says, Michael, I've been reading your books. I've been reading other books. I've been finding all these things that are troubling and disturbing. I've been putting them on the shelf. It seems like your work provided me with a healthy amount of things that I had to put on my shelf as well. And now my testimony has collapsed. As a believer, what would you say to someone who asks you two questions? How do I regain a testimony of the restored gospel, and why did you do this to me?
Well, I would say that I've had actually this kind of conversation. It's not hypothetical. When I've been told this in the past, and even as recently as the Sunstone Conference by one or two attenders who said, your book gave me the avenue and the reason to leave the church. And I've said to them and others on similar occasions, well, that's not why I wrote it. And I realize that you and others who read it could come to that conclusion that the option of disbelief is easier for you than to continue believing in something that is difficult for you to believe in. But I said, you know, that was, first of all, not my intent. Second of all, I don't regard my position as better than yours, or as more noble than yours, or as more godly than yours. Faith is a gift, and I have that, and I can't explain it really. I just have it. It's a part of me, and after all I've been through, it's conceivable I might one day become a doubter and an atheist or an agnostic. I don't think it's likely in terms of what I've been through, and I still maintain this ardent faith. But faith is a gift, and I don't regard your lack of faith or your rejection of my faith as making you less than me, or that my maintenance of this faith that you have rejected as making me better than you. It's just I'm following my path that I find inevitable, and if you find that path inevitable, then God bless you.
What if they say, how do I find it? Help me find it.
Well, I can't. I've had missionaries. I had missionaries in tears tell me, why do you have faith? And I've fasted and prayed for a testimony, even a glimmer of a testimony. And I just had to tell them that faith is a gift. The Doctrine and Covenants says it is, that some have the faith to believe on those who have that, quote, knowledge. And I can't explain. The easy answers don't work.
Isn't that kind of a cruel God, though?
Yeah. Well, it's a cruel life. Whether it's cruel for God to subject us to this life, I think we signed on knowing at least in part what it was going to be like. And so it's a joint decision on our part as well as Heavenly Father's, Heavenly Mother's. In my view, we have loving parents who are eternally ours, who eternally love us, and to whom we should be eternally indebted for this life with its ups and downs. I've been a Mormon existentialist since I was 16, and the girl I thought I would marry, the bishop's daughter, died at 16. And I was studying existentialism at that time, and that seemed to be a perfect match, European existentialism, a perfect match. Sartre and all the others who wrote of the difficulties of life, but I broke with them on life is futile. And in my view, life is futile only when God does not intervene. And in my view, he intervenes enough to take the edge off life's futility.
Maybe let's give Michael a hand for taking a
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive. Do this and joy, your hearts will swell. Should we die before our journey?